Can I say welcome to everybody who's here tonight. Thank you all for taking the time to come out this evening. Just by way of a kind of an introduction, to say that Sinn Féin over the next few weeks are conducting a series of what we call town hall meetings, and that is throughout the last term of the Assembly. We actually committed ourselves to every at least once a year having public meetings in a lot of the constituencies and the town centres to give people an opportunity to listen to our representatives in the political institutions and also to raise questions of concern to themselves. So it's by way of an intentional engagement with the broader community. Now, tonight's event is slightly different in that this is the first time we have used this particular format. We're trying to go for something more informal, if you like. But again, the idea is still to have an opportunity. I think it was described as a conversation with Martin McGuinness and Mary Lou McDonald. And that generally means you get much, you don't get much chance to speak yourself. But anyway, it is a conversation, and it's hosted very well, I've no doubt, by Jude Collins, who's a well-respected commentator and writer, has been for a long number of years. So Jude will lead the conversation with both Martin and Mary Lou. And the idea, as I've said, is to make sure that Jude will try to tease out from Martin in her own way, because normally people only have the opportunity either at formal public meetings or at press conference type of events, which is never always the best way to get people's more inner thinking and more deeper thoughts on any given topic. So the idea is that Jude will lead a conversation with both Martin and Mary Lou to see how they both see the various challenges and opportunities that are there for our people and our community and all of our peoples across the island in the time ahead, and more importantly perhaps what they see as their responsibilities and their opportunities, their hopes and wishes for the future, and how in fact we will raise all of the challenges that are there and grab the opportunities that will come our way and some more that we'll have to make. So without any further ado, as I say, I would like again to thank everybody for coming here tonight and leave it over then to Jude Collins. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Alex, and welcome everyone. It's my happy task to engage a conversation with Mary Lou and with Martin. Normally, on these occasions, the presenter says a few words about the people that he's going to be talking to. And I find myself in the situation of a young teacher who, on his first day of teaching practice in primary school, found himself in a school in North Antrim. And he said that he would get the class going, you see. So he put up a big image. He thought he'd use visual imagery to stimulate them. So he put a big image of a sheep up on the board. And he said, "Now class, anybody tell me, what is this?" And there was dead silence. So he said, "Come on now, surely some of you can tell me, what is this?" And he pointed to the picture of the sheep. Dead silence again. And then one big boy at the back put his hand up and said, "Sir, would it be a Leicester Blue?" The moral of the story being, don't assume your audience don't know a lot more about the people you're talking about or the topic you're talking about than you do yourself. And Mary Lou McDonald is the Vice President of Sinn Féin, was a member of the European Parliament, is a freshly elected TD to Dáil Éireann. She's a graduate of Trinity College. She's also studied at the University of Limerick and at Dublin City University. You can hear her regularly on Today FM with Sam Smith and on Tonight with Vincent Brown. She seems to get along well with both men. She, not as well as some other people, she was criticised very heavily for attending a commemoration of Sean Russell, an old IRA man, in 2003. The man immediately to my left, I'm sure all of you know who he is, Martin McGuinness is a former IRA man. He at present is the TD for the MP. Who's to say that someday he cannot be a TD? And is MP for Mid Ulster. He's an MLA and he's the Deputy First Minister. He's a graduate of UCB, he told me on an earlier occasion, that is to say University College Bogside, where he says he learnt more than anywhere else in his life. He has four children, and there was a rumour that one of them had been dating at an earlier stage, Nadine Coyle of Girls Aloud, but I'm told that he denies this rumour. Whether he's denying it truthfully or not, I have no way of knowing. He's known, I suppose, by most people as a person who brought the 11 plus to its knees. Some approve of that, of course, and others don't. He's also famous, of course, for his friendship with Ian Paisley. He also is a member of a small extremist minority group, I'm told, called the Pioneers Abstinence Association, Total Abstinence Association. Although he may deny this if he's been confronted with it, I'm not sure. I don't see his pin there. The last thing I leave you with is that he's not just Martin McGuinness, he actually has two other names, James Martin Pacelli McGuinness. And those of you who are religious historians will know that Pacelli is the surname of the late Pope Pius XII. So you're both welcome. Thank you. Could I start by asking you, and I'll start with you, Mary Lou, about what it was that led you to become a Republican? Both of you are leading figures in the Republican movement. Was it a particular event? Was it your own decision? Was it a family background thing? Was your family strongly interested in politics?
Well, I grew up in a Republican house, but I didn't grow up in a Sinn Féin house, if I can make that distinction. I mean, the household I grew up in, there would always have been talk, not just about domestic politics, but international affairs. My mother in particular would take very, still to this day, takes very strong views on the issues of the day. So there would have always been politics in the house. But I didn't sign up for party politics until I was a little bit further down the road. In fact, even when I was at university, when you're supposed to be at your most radical, I took the view that the most productive thing to be was involved in sort of campaigns on a case-by-case basis. And some of those were very successful, others weren't. And it probably wasn't until I was sort of well into my 20s, probably towards my late 20s, that I accepted that, in fact, if you're serious about change, you have to engage in party politics. My family is traditionally Fianna Fáil. God help us, not an admission to me. It was very clear to me that that affiliation with that particular party on my family's part was really rooted in the past rather than the present.
Were you a member of
For a short while.
What led you to leave it?
Because it was just very clear, not just for me, but for anybody who met me in that environment, that I was just simply in the wrong place.
Why? What was?
Because for me, obviously, I'm a Republican, I'm a nationalist, I want a united Ireland, I want an end to partition. But that's not the whole story. It has to also be about equality. It has to be about change in society. It has to be something that's in a serious way, more than rhetoric, that's actually about the proclamation of 1916. And Fianna Fáil, at that stage, and certainly now, had moved so far away from that politics that it wasn't the place for me.
So it was your own decision as an adult, mature adult, rather than from your family? What about yourself, Martin? Was your family a political family, or was it all the things that led you to Republican?
No. I think I came from a typical nationalist household. My father and mother both have voted for Eddie McAteer as leader of the Nationalist Party at Parliament Buildings at that time. It wasn't a political household in any way whatsoever, apart from whenever the opportunity to vote came, they went out and voted, but there was never any discussion about Irish politics. In fact, my father was a very religious person. He was someone who went to Mass and Holy Communion every day of his life.
You're not suggesting that people who are interested in politics are religious?
Definitely not. But we were a family that said the rosary. We get on our knees every single night and said the rosary. My mother came from County Donegal. She came into Derry in the 40s as a very young woman to work in the sugar factory. Met my father. He worked in an iron foundry in Foyster. And they were just a normal family. There was never any indoctrination of any description whatsoever, apart from religion.
And what was it led you to become a Republican? Was it a single event?
It was the evolutionary process that began with the civil rights movement and participation in the marches in Derry, and seeing people being beaten off the streets by the RUC, and knowing that, for example, in Derry, even before there was an IRA, during that phase of the Troubles, as they're called, which many people believe existed way back to partition and far beyond that. But knowing that neighbours of mine were being shot dead in the street by the Royal Anglian Regiment, two in particular, Desmond Beattie from the Rosemount area, and Seamus Cusick. Seamus Cusick was a nephew of a man and woman who lived in our street. And I was actually at home whenever Desmond Beattie was killed. His body was brought from Roswell Street, where he was shot by the soldiers, to the Element Road, which runs along the bottom of our street. We lived in Element Street, and it was one of the most frightening experiences of my life, to see his lifeless body. And of course, prior to that, we had Sammy Devaney beaten in his own house and dying. So, I mean, I often see outlined, you know, when I'm asked a question about my accreditation, educational wise, at UCB. My education really began after I left school. I was educated at Christian Brawlers, Brown the Hull. The vast majority of the Christian Brawlers were grand. Some of them were nutcases. Mm-hmm. And many of us couldn't really get away from school.
So, would you say then that it was events that led you to it?
Absolutely. It was the events in Derry. The fact that, what really surprised me, one of the most important situations that occurred was, as well as being very religious, my father was the mildest, kindest person you could ever hope to meet. And I was amazed that he went on the October the 5th march from Duke Street. That had a massive impact on me, because somebody who was so good loving, his best friend was actually from the Fountain area of Derry, a man called Willie McNeil, who was a Protestant. My father used to leave our house in Elmwood Street and walk down Stanley's Walk, up past the Long Tower Chapel and down through the fountain, and Willie McNeil would step outside his front door, and the two of them would walk the road together. And we all loved Willie McNeil, mostly because he was like my father, a very kindly person. But Willie had two thumbs on the one hand.
Yeah.
And as children growing up, that was a curiosity for us.
Did any of your other family members become galvanised into politics like you, or were you the only one in your family?
No,
I was the sisters.
No, I was the first.
Yeah,
I should say. I mean, your introduction was interesting, because you made the slip up about the TD. But after the election,
after the elections,
Peter Robinson said to me, "Martin, would you not like to be a TD?" And I said, "Peter, are you trying to get out of me?" Yeah. And I said, "I would like to be a TD, but I'd like to be a TD for Mid Ulster."
You're the only one in your family that's interested in politics?
No.
Well, I mean, well, of your own brother,
well, my
siblings?
Well, my younger brother William was in Cairn, yeah, in Longcash. Mm-hmm. He was there when the prison was burnt down. Mm-hmm. But
he didn't become committed to politics where you have.
No, he didn't take up a full-time role.
Yeah. You the only one in your family, really?
No, all of my family are political, to one extent, but I'm the only one that went for election, or that does this in a full-time life.
Okay.
It's more sense to it.
Okay. It's a hard life of politician. People say you get your money easy, and you get good money. Although, that's another matter. But they say it's a hard life. I remember hearing David Irvine, the late David Irvine, saying at one stage that having been a paramilitary, being a politician was a breeze. No bother. Do you find that, Martin?
Well, I was canvassing today in Cookstown, and have been for the last short while, and honestly getting a great reception everywhere. But we went to a door today, and an elderly lady came out. She says, "I'm not voting for anybody, you are all on it for yourselves."
Mm-hmm.
And she closed the door. That was the only angry response I got in the 5 or 6 days that I've been canvassing in my own constituency. I didn't even get the chance to explain that my wife gets infuriated when people ask her why is she working at a cafe on William Street in Derry. Because the reality is that I think I earned something like £111,000 a year. Which all, as soon as that's paid out, it goes straight into the Sinn Féin bank account. And we're then paid something in the region of £300 a week. The guy who drove me here tonight, gets the same money as I get.
Doesn't that
but the public don't believe that.
Doesn't that deter people from joining your party and running as candidates? Say somebody who's a doctor or a lawyer or something could make, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that if people are only joining the party and the political process because they want a huge salary, then there's a thing within republicanism that you're immediately suspicious that of their motivation.
Is that you think that's well founded?
Well, I don't know. I think, I mean, there have been instances. I mean, we've had people who left Sinn Féin during the course of the last term of the Assembly. Jerry McHugh, for example, in Fermanagh and South Tyrone. And he kept a salary.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't honour the agreement that was made, that we've all made, mm-hmm. that our salaries would go to the party, and that we would then be funded out of party funds.
But you really use it hard life?
Well, in part, yes, and in part, no. But if you opt for it, I just don't think there's a whole lot of scope for politicians to be moaning about what a hard time they get. It is tough, and you need to...
What's the hardest part of it?
For me, I can only speak personally. For me, it's the... I have two very young children, and you do find yourself in a position where you're constantly juggling. And none of us... I mean, your commitment to your politics is beyond question, but, I mean, anybody who's a parent would never like to feel that they had let their kids down, or that they'd shortchange them in any way. And there are times when you're very busy that you have to make calls. Mm. And sometimes it does mean letting a five-year-old down that you're not going to get their football match. And for me, that's the tough bit. But it's weighed up by the fact that it's a privilege to be elected to office, that you get, despite all of the talk around cynicism around politicians and people not trusting politicians... You know, Martin, you'll find this as well. When you're out on a canvas and you're in people's homes, people trust you. You get told everything. And I think there are very few walks of life where you get that sort of immediate in into people's lives. But I wanted to say something about this issue of money. Because there was a whole furore, quite correctly, in the South around the huge salaries and the huge pensions and all of this that politicians were getting. And the defence of it was... something along the lines of, well, if you pay peanuts, you'll get monkeys, you know that line. But here was the difficulty, because as it transpired in that jurisdiction, top dollar had been paid, you know, top wages, top pensions, severance, and we still got substandard politics. So I don't think there's a direct relationship between the huge money and huge quality in politics. And I think just that given the state that we're in, north and south, not least in economic terms, it's kind of back to the drawing board. And I think we need people in politics, whatever their political stripe, who are actually genuinely committed to public service and what's genuinely in the interest of the country. And then the big salaries and all of that have to take a back seat.
So you've told us about the bits that you said are privilege. Any parts that are fun? Yeah, I've heard you really enjoy doing, Martin. We really had a bloody good time.
Well, I mean, there have been very, very funny moments over the course of the past month. I'll tell you. I remember during the course of the Good Friday negotiations, there was an arrangement whereby Gerry Adams and I would meet privately with David Trimble, John Taylor, and Geoffrey Donaldson. And we had... I don't think we'd ever met with Geoffrey or with John Taylor, but there was just five of us in the room, and the meeting lasted for about an hour. And it was David with his usual nervous, fidgety self, and it was quite argumentative. And anyway, when the meeting ended, Jerry stood up and he said, "David, you know what you and I should do now? We should give each other a big hug." And I said, "David, before he does that, can I tell you, he speaks for me in many things, but not on that."
So that party indiscipline. What's the most enjoyable part for you, mate?
I suppose the camaraderie of the Sinn Féin team is really important. I mean, for instance, now there are 14 of us just since a number of weeks back in the Dáil. And there's a great geographic spread, there's a great spread of different characters. I mean, one of our colleagues is a man by the name of Micheál Coríolfig. He represents Sligo, North Leitrim. And I'm not joking you, there is nothing on this earth that would in any way flap Micheál. Micheál is the coolest customer. Now, he's been around, and what might be saying, so for a while, he was director of elections for Joe McDonnell back in the day. So he's a lot of experience under his belt. But as all of us were riding into the Dáil and in a flap over where is this and what's that and what are we to do, Micheál, as cool as a cucumber, sort of glides through it. He's a great character in that way. And each of them have that. And there's that sense of common purpose and unity. And I think even people outside of our fold kind of look in and say, you know, the Shinners, as we're called, you know, we're tight with each other most of the time. So far, so good.
There's a story told, I think it's about Winston Churchill, about the, a junior member of his party being brought into the House of Commons for the first time after being elected. And Churchill turned and pointed behind him and said, "There is the enemy." And he said, "But surely you mean over here, sir?" Pointing towards the, it was the Liberal Party at the time. He said, "No, here, your own party, that's where the enemies are." That's not the case with Sinn Féin.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's, you know, we're a growing party and you have your ups and your downs, but I don't, maybe it comes back to the money thing again. You don't have what I certainly perceive in other political parties, that kind of determination to get into a particular position, irrespective of who you have to trample over. We don't have that in Sinn Féin. I can say that very sincerely.
To move to a totally different topic and a totally different tone, the thing that's been on the headlines and on everybody's mind is the killing of Constable Ronan Kerr. And the question has been raised, how do you convince the disciplined Republicans against this kind of activity? Now, if you had one of these people in front of you now, Martin, how would you persuade them, or how would you try to persuade them that, as you said, the old Mary Lou, that the road you're taking is a peaceful road that is going to lead to Irish reunification? They're clearly convinced you're up a blind alley. How would you take some more?
Well, I have had opportunities over the course of recent years to speak to people who were at odds with the process that we were involved in. I don't like the use of the term dissident, because I believe it's okay for people to be dissidents. What I take issue with are those people who are described as dissidents, who believe that trying to plunge us back into conflict is the best way forward. So what I would do is outline the reality that we have important agreements that have been endorsed overwhelmingly by all of the people of Ireland, including 72% in the north, where we had unionists, loyalists, nationalists and republicans voting together for a new way forward. And I think that they have got a responsibility to take account of that, and take account of the fact that whenever we attended Ronan's funeral at the start of the week, Ireland was absolutely united against the people who had killed him. And I think what they have to do is take into account that there have been enormous political developments, and yes, it has been painful for everybody. You know, not easy for Peter Robinson and Ian Paisley to take the decisions that they took, but not easy for us also to take some of the difficult decisions we took, for example, on policing. But I'm very conscious of the fact, since and even before Ronan was killed, that the decisions that I took, for example, and my party took in relation to policing, brought about a situation where a very sizable percentage of young people from within the Catholic nationalist, yes, even Republican tradition, decided that they would join the police because they wanted to contribute to change in policing and they wanted to support the peace process.
But you're emphasising peace process and you're emphasising the things that you believe in. I'm saying, how would you convince them that the path you're on is towards a united, a reunited Ireland? Because they don't believe you are.
Well, I accept that maybe these people cannot be convinced. And I also accept that there are people who are opposed to this process, and they're opposed to it for different reasons. I know people here described as dissidents who don't support violence. And it's okay. I mean, it's quite legitimate for them to be opposed to the decisions that we took. But I also know that there are people out there who are described as dissidents and they are for violence for different reasons.
Yeah.
Some of it because They're opposed to us being in government with the unions. Mm-hmm. They're opposed to the terms of the agreements that were made on Good Friday, St Andrews and Hillsborough. I know there are others who are opposed to this process because they want to build financial empires for themselves. And I have actually directly challenged these people because what I actually said to these people was, I'm not going to be in government alongside Peter Robinson or Ian Paisley. I turned a blind eye to the fact that there are people out there in the community who think they can build financial empires for themselves and become involved in criminality. And then, whenever they do, and whenever they're raided by the police, come to me to get my support because of the raids on their houses. And that's actually happened to me. And I told them, I am not going to be part of that. You have a choice to make. You either support the process or you don't. I live in a three-bedroom house in the Bogside. It's a small house. Some of these guys live in mansions.
Yes, but that's not the question, actually. What I'm saying to you is there anything you could say that would persuade these people to not engage in the violence of engaging or convince them that you're on the road to your reunited Ireland by peaceful means?
I believe that we should engage with them. And I believe we should attempt to do that.
But if there's nothing you can say to them...
But in my opinion, some of the people that we're dealing with here are not convincible. So what we have to do is a couple of things. We have to support the police service north and south of the border. And they've had huge success against these groups over the course of the last 12 years. We should also challenge these people to come out, and they're hiding at the moment since they killed Ronan Kerr. They have to put their heads above the parapet. There was a struggle here which I was part of, you know, for a long time in the north. I never ran away from the cameras. I never refused to do interviews. These people cannot come forward and defend what they're doing because it is not defendable, and because they know that as a result of their activities they have now effectively isolated themselves. So I think they will be undergoing a period of reflection given the enormous reaction and even the massive turnout yesterday in Oba. I think all of that is food for thought for these people.
But you see on the second part of that question around Irish unity, I mean, the fact is that Ireland is transformed, not just the North, as a result of Good Friday, the peace process, and not just what's been done, but the potential that has been created and the dynamics. So those that argue that we are in some kind of blind alley blind themselves to the fact that all is utterly changed, and they seem to be incapable of taking that on. I mean, I don't think there is any serious commentator or person living in this part of the country who doesn't accept that this place has fundamentally changed. That's not to say that you're at the end of the journey. That's not to say that it's perfect. It is work in progress, but it is utterly changed. The very fact that you even have Republicans in government, in the power-sharing institutions, that you have the All-Ireland institutions, which I completely accept need to be developed and strengthened and built upon. The fact now, in economic terms, whether you talk about tourism or inward investment, that there's a growing understanding that we need to go at all of these issues in an All-Ireland way, means that you're at a different place. You cannot come at things now in the year 2011 as though it was 1974. It's not. Politics has changed, life has changed, people have moved on. And you ask Martin, what would he say? And I agree that there are probably some people, and you will never convince them, whether it's because they're just contrarians by nature, or just sceptics, or whatever the reason, but what you can put to them is, if you believe that the process we're embarked on is the wrong one, well then you must have some concept of what the right one is. And if your view is that the only correct way to get sovereignty and unity for the country is the military route, well then I think you're wrong. And more than that, I think as Republicans when there is a self-evident alternative that is thriving and strong north and south. But I think any Republican with an ounce of cop on, not to say principle or ethic, chooses that pathway. But that's the challenge for them to answer. And it is noticeable that, you know, Ronan Kerr, his life was taken. A young nationalist, a young man, a person that we in Sinn Féin stand with, showed that he took a decision to enter into public service. And that was a brave decision for him to join the police. And the brave ones that did this, who apparently have the holy grail in terms of Irish unity, have nothing to say.
Does anybody, I should have said this at the beginning, I'd like the audience, you know, at least briefly as we go along, to join in and ask questions if you'd like to. And we'll come back again and then I'll pursue and then we'll go to the audience again. Sure.
Over the issues regarding the police, my son's in the police office. And I know that there are people.
If you hold on a second, there's a man with a microphone. Thanks.
My son joined the police after the Good Friday Agreement. And there were people who knew me, and I would be fairly well known through music and that. And the people who knew he was in the police, most of them wouldn't talk to me. My question would be, is there any sort of even middle ranking or junior member of Sinn Féin has joined the police?
Pardon?
Well, I went down to see Nuala within hours of her son being killed. And it was very obvious from being in that household that many of the family circle were Sinn Féin voters. And I would go as far as to say that Roland Kerr voted for Sinn Féin and joined the police because he wanted to be part of change and wanted to support the peace process. I went back on the night before he was buried. I spent 45 minutes in the house, and I left the house about midnight, and a young man followed me out of the house, and I didn't know who he was. He was just dressed ordinary like you, and he said, Martin, can I speak to you? I said, yes. He said, I'm a policeman. He told me his name. He was a Catholic. He told me where he was born and where he lived. He told me where he was stationed. And he said, I just wanted to thank you for saying that you were proud of me. So I am of a view that a very substantial numbers of the new Catholic, for want of a better word, nationalist-minded, Republican-minded young people who have joined the police are in fact Sinn Féin voters. Absolutely convinced of that. And they joined it because they wanted to make a difference in policing and they wanted to support the peace process. And people have remarked on the stances that different people have taken. I mean, there was a lot of talk about Enda Kenny coming north, and first time a Taoiseach attended the funeral of a policeman killed in the north. A lot of talk about Peter Robinson's first time attending a Catholic Mass. But it was the first time ever I attended a funeral of a policeman in the north. And I believed, and still absolutely believe, that we must be very bold and forward in our defence of the changes that have taken place, many of which have come about as a result of our contribution to this process. So if Roland Kerr is prepared to stand by the process, if your son is prepared to stand by the process that occurred on Good Friday, then I, as a politician, absolutely have a duty and a responsibility to stand by them.
Okay. Any other quick question on this topic? Okay. There's a lady in the back. You hold on a second, we get a microphone to you.
I would like to ask you how you think you can help the recruitment process now that the 50-50 ratio has gone, and also how do you think you could reach out to young people in communities who maybe don't have the education, educational qualifications to join the PSNI at the moment? Because I think that if there was some sort of strategy to bring those young people along, or some special recruitment process for maybe some of the most excluded communities, that it would really contribute to more equality within policing.
Well, I mean, one of the most important features of this entire process from the very beginning, and I've often said this because I'm asked to speak at different conferences in different parts of the world, whether it be, I've been to Baghdad, I've been to Sri Lanka, we've met huge delegations of politicians from Afghanistan, and people always ask, what's the secret of resolving conflict? I remember one time going to a very private session with Cyril Ramaphosa, who was the chief negotiator for the African National Congress, whenever we went to a forest in Finland to meet with people who wouldn't even speak to one another, but we were all Iraqis. And we were all asked to make, well, effectively, contributions and to stand up before whiteboards and blackboards. And many words were written. I wrote one word on the board, and that word was leadership. If leadership is absent from any major political grouping, or even warring grouping, in a conflict resolution situation, then the prospect of resolving that conflict would be very remote indeed. And one of the things that we were very lucky to have was the fact that there were political leaders on all sides of our dispute who were prepared to show leadership. And that's what has to be done in the future. We have to show leadership, and I thought the GAA in particular showed fantastic leadership when they attended Roman Kerr's funeral in a wholehearted way. And I think the fact that all of the major political traditions, sporting organisations, all our organisations on the island came together to support Roland's mother and family sent a very, very powerful message. So what we have to do is we have to continue to show leadership, even if it means we're risking our own lives, because we are conceivably dealing with groups out there who wouldn't think nothing tomorrow morning of coming and taking my life. But that's okay. If that's the price I have to pay for peace, I am prepared to pay that price. We have to show leadership no matter how we're threatened, and no matter what is used to undermine the process that we have built up over the course of the last 15 years. So the big challenge is obviously in regard to what is happening, particularly in areas of social deprivation. And that's why during the course of our budgetary discussions, Peter Robinson and I agreed that we would have a fund which would have in its possession basically something in the region of £100 million, so that we can target those areas. Education is absolutely crucial. It was Abraham Lincoln who said in the first speech that he ever made, and in the first sentence of the first speech that he ever made, that education was the most important issue facing the people of the United States. It is the most important issue facing us, and that's why I'm not going to go into a whole rant now about the 11 plus and the long tail of underachievement that occurs as a result of what is a very socially unjust exam. But I mean, I think it has a lot to answer for in terms of the difficulties. I mean, what shocked me when I was education minister was that only 1% of children on the Shankill Road went forward to a grammar school education.
Okay, I think we're moving it into a huge secondary area. Anything you want to add briefly to that?
Because you asked about the 50-50 recruitment, and of course that was a unilateral decision. It has to be reversed, is the short answer to you. So we have a job of work to do there. But the government in Dublin equally, as co-signatories, co-guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement and everything that flows from it, equally need to apply pressure, because it is still important, I think, for anybody, like North or South, the decision to actually become a police officer or a guard, the Síochána, is a big one. You know, it's a tough task, and it can be a contentious task, And unless you're steeped in a family tradition of service of that nature, it's a big leap for people. So, and that's in the best of circumstances. So that 50-50 is absolutely critical. I was saying to Jude earlier on, it's been raised in the Dáil already. We had raised it prior to the killing of Ronan Kerr, but given the words that were spoken, the kind of solidarity and the recognition across the board of the need now to step up to the plate and defend the peace process, but also the crucial element of policing and encouraging young Catholics and Nationalists and Republicans to be part of that, the ball is now in the court of all of the politicians, London and Dublin included.
Okay. I want to move on to another topic, but just before I do that, could I very briefly ask both of you, do you think that the people who killed Ronan Kerr have partly succeeded in their objective? Their objective was to frighten Catholics out of the police service of Northern Ireland, or to deter those who are considering joining. Very briefly, do you think they have been successful to any degree?
I do not believe that they will succeed. I do accept, though, for a person making that decision and for their family, of course there will be an anxiety and a nervousness. That's absolutely to be expected. And that's the cowardly nature of this deed, because it's not about freeing Ireland or uniting Ireland. It's about frightening and bullying young Catholics, Nationalists and Republicans who take the decision in a spirit of public service, in a spirit of change, in the confidence, the emerging confidence that we can have a different Ireland, that we can have an equal Ireland, that we can have decent civic policing, who join on that basis. And these people who took this action want to stop them in their tracks.
So of course
it'll be an
partially
anxiety.
Successful?
No, I'm not going to describe it as successful. I think, of course, it will be in the calculation. But that's where Martin's position comes in and is so important in terms of that steadfast and resolute statement that we stand by those who joined the service.
Very briefly, Martin, would you say realistically they have been successful to any degree and frightening or making Catholics think twice before they join the PSNL?
Well, I think people will think twice, but I think they will think twice and they will do it. Because I think there is a momentum within the process which has been propelled further forward by the unity that was shown by all of the people of this island at Ronan Kerr's funeral. Now, I think that's a very, very important momentum, and I don't think that they're going to be able to stop it. What we have to do is continue with our work. But if I could just make this last point, because I actually said this in Stormont Castle at a press conference. There are many young Protestants joining the police, and I have to believe that they do so for the best of motives, that they too want to support what we in the political process are doing. And so, you know, some people might say, okay, well, it's easy enough for Martin McGuinness to go to Ronan Kerr's funeral because Ronan Kerr was an Irishman, he was nationally minded, may even been a Republican. He played GA. I would be as outraged and angry if a young Protestant policeman was killed in the morning. And that's our job. Our job is to defend the political changes that we have been very lucky to be able to bring about over the course of recent times. And I think that, you know, in the ongoing travels that we have been through, I've met some absolutely wonderful people from the Protestant tradition, people that prior to this process I would never have met. And many of them I would trust with my life. You know, some of them are clerics, some of them are business people, some of them are just ordinary people. I mean, David Irvine, for example. Always remember David Irvine on the day the Good Friday Agreement was signed. There was a bit of fluster within the Ulster Unionist Party. I met Martin Mansra in the corridor, and I said, well, what's the delay? You know, we've been waiting here all day, and he thought this was signed, sealed, and delivered in the morning. I says, it's just dawning on the Ulster Unionists that they're going to be in government with you. I then met I then met David Irvine. He also said Barbara de Broomfield. That's what he said in the audience. And, I then met David Irvine and I said, David, there's a bit of a setback with the Ulster Unions, but is there a big problem? I says, it'll be all right. I said, how are you with the North South Institutions? And I says, I'm grand. Billy Hodgson was standing beside him. Now, David Irvine, it turns out to be a massive friend of the process, and when he died, it was a massive loss. And I think, you know, it's quite clear that over the last 15 years or so, many of us have been on a journey, and important new relationships have been built, which I think will never be broken by any armed group, no matter how tiny or unrepresentative they are.
Okay, could I move to a broader question? The Republican notion of the progress towards a united Ireland by peaceful means is built on a condition. The Good Friday Agreement is built on a condition which says a majority in the north of Ireland must agree before you can have a change in the constitution. Is that not a massive stumbling block? Because you're going to have to ask a sizable portion, leave aside the John Taylor's famous 30% of the Catholic population who are secretly unionist, but you're going to have to convince a massive or a number of unionists who for decades, maybe centuries, have been devoted to the union to do a handbrake turn and become advocates of a united Ireland or at least support a united Ireland. Is that not a stumbling block around which there is no dodging? Mary Lou?
I don't believe it is. Let me say this very plainly, it is for those of us that believe in Irish unity, that believe in ending partition, to win others to that view. That's just a political reality. And the truth is, if you're to look at it in the nuts and bolts of how we actually get there, there's a level at which we need to plan and imagine and conceptualise the new Ireland, which is still underway. It's not as if, I think it would be very wrong for anyone to imagine that nationalist Ireland has it all figured out. You know, we don't. And therefore, it is, because of that, a process, it's incremental. And yes, it means bringing unionism or a portion of it to the view. But it also means that at a very minimum, even if Irish unity isn't your first option, your first best option, that it is an arrangement and a political and social reality that people can live with. And yes, we've a journey to make in that respect. And I think sometimes, you know, there may have been and there still is a lingering view amongst Republicans that it would be great if you could flick a switch and you're there, job done, partition ended. That actually wouldn't necessarily be the best way of going about this, because bear in mind you're talking about undoing decades of partition and two reactionary and dysfunctional systems, north and south. So it's not just about taking the border away, it's also about revisiting all of the services that we provide, our sense of ourselves, our constitutional arrangement, not just in terms of territory but in terms of political and social values. So there's work to be done. So, for instance, the civic forum and the interparliamentary forum envisaged in the Good Friday Agreement are really important mechanisms
those,
for that conversation.
Those are all the things you have to do when you convince them.
I think those are the stepping stones. That's part of the journey. That is part of the conversation in convincing people. And I think the rationale of the agreement, the rationale for unionism itself, was a notion of, you know, a sense of privilege, of kind of first class versus second class citizenship. I mean, once you dismantle and unpick all of that, then there's equally a question mark for the unionist community around the rationale for the union, because a lot of the very concrete bread and butter issues, I think the case is one, it's open and shut, that the effective way to operate is on a 32-county basis. I don't hear anybody from the world of business challenge that, because it's self-evident.
How would you, Martin, regard the task of turning unionism, or at least a portion of unionism, to face the opposite direction from which they faced for centuries?
Well, I mean, anybody who studies the Good Friday Agreement has to accept, for example, that this is an agreement that would never see the light of day in England, Scotland, or Wales. It's a unique agreement to basically bring about a resolution of conflict. And in the course of the negotiations, one of the issues that we raised was the whole issue of the Government of Ireland Act. And in the course of those discussions, Tony Blair decided that they would make a fundamental change to Britain's relationship with this island. They've never done that with Scotland or with Wales. It only affects the North. Wherein, if at some stage in the future, in a referendum, the majority of people in the North decided that they want to end the link with Britain, the British government is compelled to immediately legislate to bring about Irish reunification. Now, people had to swallow an awful lot to get the agreements that we've made, whether it be the Good Friday Agreement, the St Andrews Agreement, or the Hillsborough Agreement. And, you know, unionism had to accept that it was a huge mistake for the six counties, as we would call it, to cut itself off from the rest of Ireland. That's why we ended up with North-South institutions, which can be developed in the interest of all of the people of this island.
Well, that's true, but if we come back to the question how you would change the mind of
this is how we change the mind. We continue to make the agreements that we've made between us one. We continue to...
You're not saying, well, that's great, that you're helping us to run the Northern Ireland, and we're jolly grateful to you, and we're going to continue what we've done for the last 100 years almost now.
No, well, I don't see it like that. I think that there will come a time, I think it's inevitable, that we're going to see the reunification of Ireland. I can't say exactly when it's going to happen, but I do believe that we have put in train a process which will see that happen by purely peaceful and democratic means. You see, it's okay to say we want to see the reunification of our country by purely peaceful and democratic means. There are some people, when you say that, think you've no right to say it. As if, you know, I'm so offended by what you said, that that is not a legitimate political aspiration or objective. Well, I think that it is eminently reasonable. I mean, for example, we went to the Economic Investment Conference at the State Department last year. Peter Robinson and I sat in a room with, many very senior business people from multinational companies, all interested in what we have to offer. And one guy in particular said, you know, I look at a place with 1.5 million people, and I'm not that excited. But I look at a place with 6 million people, and I get excited. So I think what we have to do is that we have to continue to build relationships with our unionist and loyalist countrymen and women, Catholics, Protestants, and dissenters. What binds us together are the agreements that we've made. They've been difficult agreements, difficult for everybody, difficult for us. But if we don't stand by loyally those agreements, then we're lost. The entire process is lost.
You don't think that the whole notion, either, of national sovereignty, which is at the heart of Sinn Féin policy, along with equality, which is another issue we might want to explore, but the whole notion of national sovereignty, maybe John Hume was right. Maybe it is a post-nationalist era we're in. Would the bailout in the South not be an example of that, where a country... We depend on each other. It is a more globalised world we live in, and notions of national sovereignty are outdated.
But you look at it from our perspective. I mean, there are more Irish Republicans in the north of Ireland now than ever before in the history of the northern state. At the last two elections, the European election with Barbara Stewart and the Westminster election, Sinn Féin emerged as a party with the largest number of votes. Now, that doesn't necessarily translate that we're going to emerge as the largest party with the largest number of seats in the Assembly elections. Who knows?
And you, the First Minister.
But who knows what it... Well, I'd like to see two First Ministers. But I've had my say about that. But I think if people, particularly people who agree with us, see the increase in support for Irish republicanism, an Irish republicanism that is committed to achieving its objectives now by purely peaceful and democratic means. I think we can point to the pathway to reunification. But, you see, the important thing for me is to go along that pathway in a way that brings as many people as possible with us. In other words, go along that pathway not in a provocative sense that offends unionists or loyalists, but to explain to people that, for example, in terms of an all-island economy, that it actually makes much more sense in terms of economic prosperity for our people, all of our people in the north, if we're working together.
To go back to the question of national sovereignty.
You see, I think the bailout, as it's called, and the IMF coming in the south, far from confirming, you know, the death of sovereignty and that we're in some kind of post-nationalist environment, actually underlined the value of sovereignty and what happens when you lose it. Because as things stand now, it is not even the newly elected government that will make decisions on whether or not to restore the minimum wage, whether or not to levy certain taxes, to make charges. All of those now need to go through the filter of the IMF and the EU. And if they say no, well, then the government, this administration, sort of sits on its hands and says, well, that's not a runner now. And now we're critical of them for that because we don't believe that they've been forthright enough in our defence. But the reality is that economic sovereignty has been lost. And we pointed out the irony of the situation where, on the one hand, in here in this part of Ireland, there's, I think, an increasing realisation that the Assembly needs fiscal powers to function, that would be a positive addition. So, and an assertion of sovereignty, that whilst that argument is happening in the North East, down in the rest of Ireland, that economic sovereignty has been frittered away. And sovereignty is like lots of things, probably like virtue or whatever. It's not until you've lost it that you realise its value. And I think that's what's happened. Sovereignty has never been a more popular term. It's tripping off the lips of politicians who, through campaigns around the Lisbon treaties, as Barbara will know, and Nice, and even Maastricht, said sovereignty is a dead letter. It doesn't matter anymore. Well, it does, and we're discovering that.
I think the comment that we were living in a post-nationalist era was one of the few mistakes that John Hume made. In fact, the SDLP, if you look at their record over the course of the last number of years since Mark Durkin, for example, became leader and then passed on to Margaret Ritchie, they're always extolling now the virtues of a united Ireland. So it's a united Ireland for Snow Ireland.
Yes.
Sinn Féin Party may want to.
Sorry, do you want to get a microphone or we have it?
Sinn Féin Party may want a united Ireland and all that, but if you check a vote down south, people don't want us. They've turned around and said that. They turned around and said if we're enough troubles, they don't want the north. So I don't think the people want us. As simple as that.
Let Mary Lou perhaps respond to that.
I think certainly nobody wants a return of the Troubles. And you're right, when the conflict was at full tilt in the north, the great angst in the south was that it would spill over the border, which it did on many occasions, not least in my own city in 1974, and the same day in Monaghan, 34 lives were lost. So yes, there's an anxiety around that. I think you're wrong, though, when you say, you know, the people in the south don't want us. I think you have to distinguish between positions that are taken by politicians and the political class and what the popular will is within the grassroots. Scratch any southerner, to use the term, and what you find is a nationalist. And I think there is still an understanding that the big national project is reunification. And you mentioned the diaspora earlier on, and we've had discussions in the South. How do you get buy-in from Irish America, from the Irish in Australia? All sorts of things were posited But really the project for the global Irish community is unity in the home place.
Do you think that the view that this lady has articulated of people in the South not giving a damn about the border, they're happy enough with it where it is, and do you think that's anything to do with media presentation of the whole issue of partition?
There are very strong vested interests who do not want a united Ireland. That's for absolute certain and sure. But we talked there about Ronan Curran without revisiting that particular topic. I think the reaction all across this country told you that far from being indifferent or detached, southern people from Cork to Donegal, ironically, somehow Donegal is southern, which is slightly bizarre, but people everywhere were deeply concerned, deeply moved by that, and do have a stake, a personal and a political stake in the success of the process and in Irish
Do you think there's a media bias against Republicans in general and Sinn Féin in particular among the media in Ireland?
In some quarters, absolutely. It's not even bias. I think it's, in some quarters, I think it's open hostility. That doesn't apply across all of the media. But certainly, in terms of the journey to Irish unity, I think we have to acknowledge that partition did its job, did its work, that there are, as imperfect as the systems are north and south, that there are vested interests that would wish to see the status quo untouched and unchanged.
Among the media.
And there are elements of that, strong elements of that within the media.
Do you think the majority of the media are anti-republican in the south?
I'm not sure that I'd say a majority. I would certainly say independent newspapers are. And they, of course, are a huge holding. I mean, they make no bones about it. I mean, in the course of the last election, certain of their publications, their titles, told us that they are entitled to take a political position, that their political position is to attack Sinn Féin and Republicans, and that they would be sticking to that position. End of conversation. They were that blatant with us. But don't read the general public view in the South simply because of an editorial line in a particular set of newspapers. I think that would be to misread.
Do you think
this was on the television a while ago, and we were interviewing people, and people thought that the South, that they have enough not trouble, but economic wise and everything else, and they're all right. They were making out that they were all right on their own, and they just didn't want.
We're not all right on our own, and I think recent events, the solvency of the state is in question. But as we speak now, if you were to go onto the streets of Dublin and take a vox pop and say, what's your biggest concern? Yes, it's jobs, it's emigration, it's the economy. But those aren't things, there isn't a hermetic seal around the 26. Those are issues in the six counties as well. So people's immediate preoccupation is around those issues, but don't mistake that for an indifference around the broader future direction of their country. And I think as it becomes clear to people that the solution to our economic woes, that the way in which we can get better investment, get better jobs, stop young people from emigrating, that the solution is 32 county wide, well then of course people are going to take a more active and engaged interest in it.
Let's go back to the question of the media. Do you think the media in the north give Republicans a fair crack at it?
Well, first of all, I want to talk about the media in the south.
Okay. Well, you're talking about the one in the north, aren't you?
Yeah. Oh, well, the independent group of newspapers in the south is probably the group that reaches the vast majority of people. And they are a very partitionist entity, in my view. For example, if I was asked who the political correspondents of the Irish Times are, I can tell you right away. If I was asked who reports on the North from the independent group of newspapers, I couldn't tell you, because they've never interviewed me. Maybe at an odd event, somebody will sneak up beside you and say, I am such and such from the independent, what do you think about this? But nobody has ever asked for an in-depth interview, because they believe in keeping republicanism off their pages unless it's a negative story. That's the reality that we're dealing with. The independent group of newspapers, which controls not just the print media, but many radio stations in the south, has a very partitionist and anti-republican agenda.
How about the north?
And there is partitionism in the South. And it was, just give one example, at a time whenever there was a lot of intrigue about why so many cars were travelling north to Newry to Shell, we had the Lord Mayor of Dublin, who I think was from the Fianna Fáil party, telling people that it was very unpatriotic of them to do so. And we then had actually Brian Lenehan, the finance minister, saying exactly the same thing.
Have you knew what he meant, didn't you?
Well, I knew exactly what he meant. We were a foreign place.
What about the media in the north?
And they were boosting the coffers of the. Well, the media in the north, I think, undoubtedly interview Republicans much more often than the independent group of newspapers in the south would do. But there is also a prejudice against Sinn Féin. I mean, the Irish news is more sympathetic to the SDLP than it does to Sinn Féin.
They would deny that.
Well, of course they would deny it, but that is what I believe, and I've told them so directly. The reality is that, I mean, for a period, whenever I was working with Ian Paisley in the Office of First and Deputy First Minister, there were more photographs of me in the newsletter than there was in Irish news. And it even went as far at one stage where I think they accepted a photograph of Margaret Ritchie, which had me in it alongside President Obama and herself, but which the SDLP took me out of. But I mean, I think that the Irish News is seen as a paper that has been traditionally supportive of the SDLP. That's okay, but I do think that at times we get a very unfair press.
Doesn't make economic sense for the Irish News to be opposed if they were, as you say, opposed to Republicans, or Sinn Féin, say, because most Irish News readers in the North vote for Sinn Féin. Would that be true? If you say most Catholics vote for Sinn Féin, most people who read the Irish News are Catholics, therefore. Yeah. It would make economic sense for them to be pro-Sinn Féin rather than pro-SDLP.
Well, I think that the vast majority of people who buy the Irish News who are Sinn Féiners buy it for the GAA News. Because it's not that they're not going to see anything positive apart maybe from Jim Gibney's article. Apart from that, I mean, we have a situation where it comes back to the whole issue of the events of the last week or so. And I've said this on countless occasions over recent time, that there is a complacency within the media about where we're at within the process. You know, it's like, okay, you've had 4 years together. You were with Ian Paisley, you were with Peter Robinson, and Eden Bredesen forgotten. So none of that counts. When I actually remember the first time we sat down with our MLAs in Stormont after they were elected, and I made a speech at it, and I said, well, what you have to remember is that we're now getting into government with people that we've never had a conversation with before. The next 4 years is going to be a rocky road, but your job is to build relationships, be civilized, be cordial, build positive working relationships with the unions here in this building, because the real benefit of this assembly will come in the next term. And the fundamental thing that changed everything, in my opinion, in terms of how we go forward in the next term, was what happened within the last 15 months. People talk about the first day when Ian Paisley and I stood up, then when Peter Robinson came in. But I think the situation that has changed everything was the negotiations that took place at Hillsborough, where Peter Robinson had a huge job to deliver the DUP for the transfer of power on policing and justice. And I'm not going to go through all of the major statements that were made by very heavy hitters within the DUP about when that would happen or not happen. But the fact that that happened, I have a far better working relationship with Peter Robinson since Hillsborough than I had prior to Hillsborough. But we're dealing with the media in the north, which at every opportunity thinks it has a right to take a liberty with the gains that were made over the course of the last 4 years. And many of them, in fact, take it for granted what has been accomplished, as if, okay, well, you've done that. But now that you've done that, it's our job to slag these off, which they do on a regular basis. And I know for a lot of politicians, not me, but for all of them, it can be very disparaging whenever you see people effectively say, oh, that crowd up on the hill, kind of wasters. Yeah. Don't do anything. The folks in the Hull are denigrated and they're berated at every opportunity as if they're totally and absolutely worthless. I don't believe that the people here on the Hull are worthless. I don't believe that Peter Robinson is worthless. I don't believe that Sammy Wilson is worthless. I don't believe that people here in my party or in the SDLP and the Alliance Party and the Ulster Unionists are worthless.
Okay. Could I, this question would be irrelevant to you, Mary Lou, because I would ask you, can you remember 1966? You remember 1966, Mark?
I was 16.
Now, in 1966, there was great furore because of the 50th anniversary of 1916. We're coming up to the 100th anniversary of 1916 and the 100th anniversary of 1912. Mm-hmm. And there'll be celebrations, commemorations, all sorts of ceremonies. Do you think will this deepen in the north the divisions? Will it, in the south, excite the sense of national identity? What impact will it have?
Well, I certainly there is already a consciousness that we're coming into a period where you're going to have a whole series of those historic centenary events. I mean, the 1913 lockout, for instance, in Dublin will be a huge occasion, and I presume across the country. And I think it's difficult to prejudge exactly the impact, the precise impact that it will have. I think what we can say at this juncture is that there will be individual and joined up moments for remembrance, reflection and forward planning. And that's the best way that I can put it to you. I think certainly in terms of the 16 centenary, the proclamation will be dusted down again. It will be solemnly intoned all across the country.
Will it excite?
I very much hope that when it is, that those reading and listening will actually take on board what it actually says and ask the question, how far have we come in 100 years? Have we actually honoured any of this political vision, which was so cutting edge and progressive for its time and remains so to this day? Will it be divisive? I don't believe it has to be. Will it excite a level of pride and purpose? I hope that it will. But I don't think pride and purpose necessarily result in alienation and resentment. And I think maybe, I don't remember 1966, I wasn't around in 1966.
I didn't think you were.
But I think some of the analysis of that time was that it radicalised people, and that it was part of a chain of events that certainly was around the nationalist people in the north asserting themselves, asserting their position as Irish men and women. Some people will take a view that that was a negative chain of events. I take a view that it was a positive chain of events and an inevitable one. But bear in mind, we'll be celebrating this centenary in a totally changed landscape. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how we can use it to assert for the Republican occasions our Republican values, but also bringing, as Martin says, people along with us. I think that'll be the...
Can I ask a question?
Yes, very briefly.
Just go back on,
very briefly.
Just go back on something that was already mentioned. Yeah. Is Dallas, the Joint First Minister. The question I want to ask the Joint First Minister is based around this relationships, and it has to be said within Stormont that you were just talking about. In the new Parliament, which you're probably going to end up leading, Martin, are you going to look at the right of veto? Because we have a classic example in this area. Planning is a major issue, and where the one of the other parties, against all opposition, automatically implied the right of veto on something that was not ever designed to be used on. And I think it's an absolute disgrace that this has actually happened. Are you going to look at that?
I mean, planning is a huge issue. It's a huge issue because it affects obviously people in this area, but on a bigger spectrum of things. It has a massive impact on how we develop our economy, which we placed front and centre of our programme for government. It's a huge issue. We get it everywhere. Yes, so that's something that needs to be looked at. And I think that we all have a responsibility as we see the maturing of politics. And I actually think that we are seeing a maturing of politics. This issue was raised about how we deal with the covenant, the Ulster Covenant of 100 year anniversary, how we deal with 2016. I think we deal with them against the backdrop of the agreements that we've made. We have to stand by the agreements that we've made, and the agreements that we have made compel us over the course of the foreseeable future to make a success of the project that we're all involved in. I mean, from the institutions were first established, I find myself as education minister and an executive that collapsed three times from December 1989 until October 2002. It was a very unhappy period for someone like me who was very passionate about trying to bring about fundamental change. And then we had this gap up until 2007, and that's a whole other story. You know, going on the down street as I did after the Assembly elections of 2003, and hear Tony Blair saying that his policy was going to be to reverse the political fortunes of the Ulster Unionist Party.
Yeah, but come back to the question of divisiveness.
Well, I don't think that they will be divisive. Why will they not be divisive? Because I think we're seeing a new political maturity. Peter Robinson and I and many others within the process recognise the responsibilities that we have to bring all of this work through to a successful conclusion. And if that means dealing with the Ulster Covenant in a very mature way in 2012, we'll deal with it in a very mature way. The last thing we want to do is be involved in anything which destabilises the gains that we have made. And we have made huge gains over the course of the last 4 years, out in particular over the course of the last 15 months. The last thing I want to see as a result of 2016 is anything that's happening there in terms of commemorative events which destabilises the gains which will be further developed, I believe, by that stage if we continue to work in a good spirited way to continually implement the agreements that we've all signed up to.
Very quickly, because the time's nearly up. Final question, so keep your answer very brief. You've told us how much and how well everybody in Sinn Féin gets along with everybody else in Sinn Féin. If you had to be stuck in a lift for 2 hours, which member of Fianna Fáil would you like to be stuck in?
You've written that to me.
Yes,
you're
Mary Lou.
But there aren't that many left to choose from. Let me see. I'm just mentally going across the ranks. Willie O'D, because it would really, really sicken him. As uncomfortable as I would be, he would be doubly so. So yeah, Willie O'D and his moustache, the man from Limerick. That's my choice.
Martin, if you had to be stuck in the lift with somebody from the unionist tradition for 2 hours.
Well, if I came at it with the same motivation as Mary Lou, I'd probably pick Gregory Campbell. But I don't.
You don't pick Gregory Campbell?
No, if I was stuck in a lift for 2 hours, I'd probably pick Sammy Wilson.
Why?
Because he's a good crack.
Very limited. Thank you. Any final questions anybody wants to ask? We're pretty much out of time, but if there was somebody who wanted to ask a quick question, we'll take a really brief minute.
Well, it's not such a question, it's more a statement. Just, there's a group of us here from the Holy Land. One of the things that we would really hate to be stuck with in a lift would be a group of drunken students on St. Patrick's Day. And one of the things that we would like, and Alex Maskey certainly is giving us a lot of help in that direction, but if we have some commitment from some minister, someone like yourself, to say that we could do much more to try and resolve the issues there, we'd be very, very grateful.
Well, I agree. We've spoken to Alec about this on quite a number of occasions, and there's actually a cross-departmental responsibility to deal with it, but it is something that we're taking very seriously indeed.
Okay, and one more question here.
Yeah, MEF is going to bring a lot of bread and butter issues to the table, but it's also bringing a referendum. So should any individual choose to vote in the referendum on AV on May 5th, in what way would you encourage them?
Well, I have to say, from canvassing my own constituency over recent days, the vast majority of people haven't got a clue what the AV referendum is about. I lean more towards thinking yes, but I'm not bothered either way, to tell you the truth. I think it's going to be lost anyway, because I think there are too many Tories and Labour people in England who are against it, so I think you're probably going to see first past the post. One of the reasons I'm going for it is that in the Assembly elections and local government elections here, we have 1-2-3 PR, so it does actually complicates voting for us if we're then asking people to vote X. much better if we have everybody voting against PR.
Mary Lou,
yeah.
No, I agree with that.
Okay. Anybody else? Final question at the back here.
Can you give us an idea of what the operation tax is going to be when you get back to the swimmer?
Yeah, well, obviously this is a very important issue, and it's something that my party has majored on for years. Some of the other parties were very lukewarm about it, even opposition in the beginning. But I'm very pleased that all of the other parties have now come around to supporting a reduction of corporation tax. It's hugely important, but the deal has to make sense. It has to make economic sense. And I think there is no doubt from our visits to the United States. And remember, when Peter Robinson and I first travelled in the United States, people used to say, what's Martin McGuinness and Peter Robinson going to the United States for in the teeth of an economic recession? They won't get one job. Yet we went to Los Angeles, we spoke to Universal and HBO, Universal came to Belfast, and we went at a time whenever the two soldiers were killed and Stephen Carroll were killed by these groups, whenever there were wobbles in the United States about whether or not they would come. But both HBO and their Game of Thrones has now been trailed on Sky Atlantic. People in the North don't even know it was made on location in the North. And it's one of the most spectacular things ever made in the North. But the most important thing for me, during the period Universal and HBO were at the Paint Hall, was that about 700 people were employed there. And they were from all over the North. We've had the Liberty Mutual investment. Our relationship with Duncan Niederauer at the New York Stock Exchange brought 500 jobs through the Euronext company, the Citigroup. So what is very, very clear from the United States companies is that if we can get a reduction in corporation tax on terms that suits us and on an equal basis with the South, we will bring thousands and thousands of new jobs to the North.
Okay, thank you very much, Mary Lou. Thank you, Martin. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
So again, I'd like to thank everybody for coming along. And a thought just struck me there: what if Willie O'Dea and Gregory Campbell were stuck in the lift together? I would like to pay money to watch that one. Can I thank Jude for being a very, very good host? Mary Lou's been on the road actually from 5 o'clock this morning. She was up in Donegal today and she's back into Belfast this afternoon around about 4:30, and she's here tonight and driving back to Dublin tonight, I think, doing questions time in the morning. And again, thank Martin, who has stayed in the city all day, and he's been back home again to his wonderful daddy just very shortly to be back in Belfast very early tomorrow morning again. So again, thanks very much to Martin. Obviously the people who put the sound on for us this evening, it's been very, very helpful and very worthwhile. And but more importantly, I'd like to thank each and every one of you who took the time out to come here this evening. I hope you found the evening interesting. I know only a few of you got a chance to ask a few questions, but nevertheless I think that we get a flavour from the contributions earlier on and the answers and some of the questions, that there's a big wide range of issues that we're all very keenly focused on to get resolution to. And I would just like to make an assurance tonight that this particular format, this conversation, will for us be the start rather than the end of the process of engagement. So thanks very much for all of you for coming here tonight. Thank you for your attention.